Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're on the Earth.
It's a good way to start.
Yes.
Just get the basics out of the way.
Yes. You want to know our location? I'll tell you something else. As you all know, the Earth spins at a particular rate.
It does.
The Earth also circles
once a day.
The sun every
all the way around.
Year.
Yep. 365 of those.
And then there's a moon which marks the months. Now, these various astronomic events, which we rely on to tell time, seem fixed to us. But oh my God, I was very surprised to find out that the things that define time have been changing and changing radically, and there's evidence on Earth for what used to be.
And today we're going to tell you three stories that, in their own various ways, kind of unfix it, would you say?
I would say we're going to unfix time in this hour.
In an earthly sense.
In an earthly sense. And we're going to begin... Well, we'll begin with a discovery that I learned about, and it involves a little creature in the sea called a coral.
Coral's a shelly animal, a little creature.
That's Neil Shubin.
I'm a paleontologist, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. Just like a clam has a clamshell has an animal inside it, so do corals.
A little fleshy, wormy thing?
Exactly, and it wears its skeleton on the outside. And because they sit in the same place for their whole life, they're really sensitive to local environmental changes.
Meaning what?
Think about it this way. Let's just sort of think about what happens to a creature as it lives its life in the water, which is what these things do. You know, we live in a world of cycles on cycles. Temperature rises and falls. Light rises and falls. The tides rise and fall several times in the course of a day. So you think about what that means for creatures living in water.
What it means for corals, says Neil, is that they're growing.
They're slapping on new skeleton, if you will, new shell.
In time with these cycles of rise and fall, and light and dark, hot and cold, and...
Hello, hello.
Hi.
You can actually see these changes written onto their shells, maybe into their shells.
Emily.
Andy.
And that's why Andy Mills and I called up our pal Emily Grassley, whose job is,
I'm the chief curiosity correspondent of the Field Museum in Chicago.
That's your actual title.
The chief curiosity correspondent, yes, it is.
You brought some corals, did you?
We have many corals. We have corals all over the studio desk right now.
All right.
Let's cut it.
Because when you cut into these shells...
Oh, it's warm.
We have a little bit of water. We can spritz it on there, cool it off.
Right off, you can see a pattern. You see these gray stripes.
And they're all different variations of gray, but some are really dark gray and some are tan.
They're like bands running either through or across the shell.
They kind of radiate out like the bands of a tree.
And between the bands, there are spaces. You got a stripe, then a space, a stripe, then a space. Stripe than a space, but
when you hold it up close to your eye,
if you look closer in between the stripes, you can see sort of.
Wow, you can see the lines. Wow,
you can see that the spaces are filled with faint little lines,
and that's where the piece of this story is just so fascinating.
Because in 1962, a paleontologist,
Professor John Wells,
was looking at some corals just like these.
He was just sitting there saying, okay, well, what can we figure out from coral shells? So what he did is he did something really simple. He says, well, golly gee.
Why don't I count the number of little lines between these bands, just to see. So he starts counting, 100, 200 lines, 300, 310, 320. And every time he counted...
He got a number.
Around
360, 365.
Wait a second.
Familiar number, no?
Doesn't take a whole lot of inference that, hey, maybe those individual rings represent, you know, a daily pattern.
Meaning each of these little lines actually equaled a day.
Well, and why? They're not just making a gray mark after 365.
No.
What are the gray lines?
Well, the thicker lines are the times of the year when the coral grows a lot. But if you've got a summer coral, then it grows a lot in one summer, then it goes quiet, then it grows a lot the next summer. So that's, again, that marks a year. Those big bands are kind of like, na, 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 Happy New Year. Na, 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 Happy New Year. Na, 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 Happy New Year.
There are actually calendars and clocks inside each of these things. You just have to know how to read them.
So this guy, Professor Wells,
what he did was then, this is the really bold bit, I thought, which is he then said, well, okay, that's a living coral. Let's look at some fossils.
He was, after all, a paleontologist.
You know, so he was at Cornell University, and you know, Cornell University is surrounded by rocks around, you know, 370 or so million years old. And he collected some nice corals, and there are a lot of nice coral fossils known from there.
And he opened up these ancient skeletons.
And he did the count.
Found 100 days, 200 days.
He was expecting
300 days.
360 to 365.
368.
Then lo and behold, he found
400?
Between 400 and 410.
Really?
Yeah, and he looked at lots of specimens.
That number, the 400 number, kept showing up.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that it's now reasonable to think that back in the day, you know, 380 million years ago, there were more days in a year. And he published a paper saying more or less that. And right away, clam scientists said, well, if that's true for corals, then it's got to be true for my animal, the clam. And the oyster people said, well, it's got to be true for oysters. And mussel folks, it's got to be true for mussels.
This paper set off a bit of a cottage industry of folks applying this technique to other species. In looking at these other species, they found that the general trend is absolutely correct.
That when you compare modern animals to ancient animals, you will find they record, the old ones, more days in a year.
So you go back to a time period called the Ordovician, which is about 450 million years ago. A typical year had about 415, 410 days in it.
Really?
If you go to the time period I work on in the Devonian, about 360 million years, probably about 400. So what you see is the number of days in a year has declined from over 400 to what we have now, which is 365.
That's really, so we have lost 40 days since the...
Yeah, since creatures first started to walk on land.
So now comes the obvious question. Why? Why would there be more days then than there are now?
Okay, wait a second. So a year is a trip around the sun.
And that's a trip. That's right.
And days are when we spin around and says we're going around the sun. Okay, so maybe if you want to squeeze more days into a year, maybe it just means the trip around the sun took longer back then?
Well, if you ask astronomers about that, I asked Chris Impey at the University of Arizona, and he says...
There's no sense that the length of time it takes the Earth to orbit the sun is changing.
Because the Earth's orbit around the sun is basic physics, and it hasn't really changed significantly. He's pretty sure of that.
So then what is it?
Well, Chris says the answer takes us back about 4.5 billion years to a time when the Earth was very young.
So there was this crazy period of time lasting about 50 million years.
Which they call the Great Bombardment Period.
There was still a lot of debris left over from the formation of the solar system. So the meteor impact rate was thousands of times higher. The Earth was still like a tacky magma. And so there was hail, brimstone, endless rain. I mean, kind of crazy time, really. And a bit of that mayhem, of course, we think gave birth to the moon.
There was a huge collision, and a rock about the size of Mars banged into us, flung a hunk of Earth shrapnel into orbit, and those pieces coalesced and became our moon, which is now sort of parked right next to us.
And so it sort of tugs us around in a kind of hefty way. And
wait,
the
I thought we tugged the moon.
Oh, it works both ways. You know, we tug the moon and the moon tugs us and the force is actually equal.
So it's kind of like a dance.
It's a dance.
I tug the moon and the moon tugs me.
Exactly. It's a celestial waltz.
I see the moon. The moon sees me. Down through the leaves of the old tree.
And it's that dance, that waltz, that explains why the Earth used to have 450 days in a year, then 400 days in a year, and now only 365.
Well, I don't see how this explains anything yet.
Well, first of all, let's just remember what a day is. A day is a full spin of the planet, from the sun coming up in the morning, then going down, coming up the next morning. So one spin, a total spin, equals a day.
Yes.
We all know that. Now, today we make 365 of these spins as we orbit the sun. That would be a year.
Right.
But back when the Earth was born, when it was all by itself dancing alone, that in those days it spun faster. It was making more of these spins as it went around the sun, so a year had more days in it. But then along comes the moon to join the dance, and now here's the key, according to Chris.
Earth is spinning faster than the moon is orbiting it.
A dance party takes a month to come around us. We take, 24 hours, And you know how it is when you're dancing with a partner who's slower than you are? Then you have to tug them along, which is what has happened here gravitationally. We are constantly tugging the moon along. It is constantly dragging us down. There's a transfer of energy here that over billions of years has caused the Earth's spin to slow down just a little bit, a teeny bit. And as the spin has slowed, well, our days have gotten longer.
And if you do the math, you calculate that the day is getting longer by 1.7 milliseconds each century.
1.7 milliseconds each century.
What this means on a daily basis is that today was 54 billionths of a second longer than yesterday. And the day before that was 54 billionths of a second longer than the day before. And the day before that was 54 billionths of a second longer than the day before that, which was 54.
And if you extrapolate that out over the, you know, millions of years people like me think about.
That's Neil Shubin again, the paleontologist.
That becomes quite significant.
So you're telling me that today is the shortest day of the rest of my life.
Yes.
Andy worries about these things.
Well, you're not going to live longer because of this, I'm sorry to say, but...
No, so this moon dance does not affect the ticking of time. It just affects what we choose to call a day. And by the way, one of the consequences of this dance is as we lose a little energy to our moon every year, and the moon picks up a little energy from us because these things are always equal. Think about like when you throw a ball, the more energy you use, the further the ball is away from you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we... add a little more energy to the moon very slyly moves a little further away from us. Every year, it's about...
a couple of inches.
According to Chris.
Yeah.
And he says if you go back about 4 billion years...
the moon was originally about 10 times closer than it is now.
Ten times closer?
Imagine the moon looking 10 times bigger than it does now. That would have been crazy.
Whoa.
Also, the days would have been 6 hours long.
6 hours long?
To me, what this says is that everything that we take for granted as normal in our world, you know, ice at the poles, seas in certain places, continents configured the way they are, the number of days in a year, all that is subject to change. And all that has changed. All that has dramatically changed over the course of the history of our planet. And that includes how we measure time itself. So, you know, when I'm sitting in a hole in the middle of the Arctic digging out a fish fossil, every now and then, you know, I pinch myself and say, here I am in the Arctic digging out a fish fossil, you know, that lived in an ancient subtropical environment. You know, the juxtaposition between present and past sometimes is utterly mind-blowing, but it's very informative about our own age and that we, you know, we think things are eternal, but they're not. Everything is subject to change. Change is the way of the world.
And before we go, I just want to play you a little bit of a... can we do this? Can we just add an end to the end? Because that's
what I'd like to do.
Sure,
yeah.
I was talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's an astrophysicist and who thinks about spin, which we've just thought about, thinks about the inner solar system, which we've just thought about. So here's him and I talking about holding on to time. It's a little goofy, but here it is, just for the fun of it. So if you're on Earth... and you're walking in, you know, around Quito on the equator. If you're walking at 4 miles an hour, you know, your day will go sort of the normal way. The sun will rise behind you, go overhead, and then go down the other side.
Well, if you're stationary,
if you're stationary,
it'll be a 24-hour day, yes.
Yeah.
If you started walking on the equator, depending on which direction you walked, your day will either last longer or shorter. Okay, so if you walk west, the faster you walk, the longer your day will become. You could walk at a pace where you have a 25-hour day, a 27-hour day. There's a speed with which you can walk on the equator and the Earth going west where your day lasts forever, and that is the rotation rate of the Earth. You would have compensated
roughly what would be a gerbil.
A gerbil running on a beach ball, a rotating beach ball. So that would, on the top of a beach ball. So that speed for the equator is about 1,000 miles an hour. So the equator moves 1,000 miles an hour, and that gives us the 24-hour day. If you want to go 1,000 miles an hour the opposite direction, you will stop the day. The sun will never move in the sky, and you'll have your day will last.
Superman did that once, I think, when he had this thing with Lois.
Superman would have so messed up everybody on Earth for having stopped the rotation of the Earth, reversed it, and then set it forward again.
Yes, he did that.
He would have scrambled all, not anything not bolted to the Earth would have been
completely... Really, would have flown off?
Yeah, yeah. So depending on your latitude, any equatorial residents, if you stop the Earth, they were going at 1,000 miles an hour with the Earth. You stop the Earth and you're not seat-belted to the Earth, you will fall over and roll due east 1,000 miles an hour. Our mid-latitudes, we're in New York, you can do the math, we're moving about 800 miles an hour due east. And stop the Earth, we will roll 800 miles an hour due east and crash into buildings and other things that are attached to the Earth.
That are attached to the
Earth. Right?
But let's, going back to Venus now.
Oh, you want to go to Venus? Isn't this enough for you?
No, I wanted to, the whole point was to go to Venus, because it's so different there.
Yeah, on every way. No, it's about the same size and about the same surface gravity, but that's it. It's 900 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a runaway greenhouse effect. It is heavy volcanic activity that repaves the surface periodically, so there are very few craters on Venus.
Just unpleasant in general.
Unpleasant. It rotates very slowly.
Well, that's why I want to stop. So how slowly does it rotate?
You know, I don't remember the exact number.
4 miles an hour or something like that.
It's some very slow rate at its equator. Slow enough so that you don't need you don't need airplanes to stop the sun. You don't need special speed devices. You could probably trot and stop the sun on the horizon, or wherever the sun is
so
in the sky.
So if you're that guy from Jamaica, what's his name?
Usain Bolt.
Usain Bolt. Like this, and you happen to be on Venus for a little while, and you decide to go for a run. What happens to Usain during the run?
Okay, so normally the sun would rise in one direction and set in the other. Depending on which direction you chose to run in, you could reverse your day and have the sun rise in the opposite side of the sky than it normally would. But I think Venus is rotating slowly enough that you wouldn't have to be Usain Bolt. I'd have to check my numbers on this.
I don't think you would. Maybe you'd, in order to have the sun actually sort of seem to go backwards, that's what you're saying, is the sun would go backwards.
Yeah.
So you'd be having lunch, you're Usain Bolt, and you're going to say, now I'm going to run, and the sun's going backwards towards the morning's horizon.
You can reverse the sun, that's correct. In fact,
that is a really good reason to sprint. I think.
Well, but who cares about the sun anymore?
Me? If I were Usain Bolt, I go up to him
and say... Is the sun telling you when to eat lunch? I don't think so. Your stomach is telling you when to eat lunch. You're saying, okay, Usain, you eat breakfast, but you want to have lunch real soon? Run so that the sun is now at the top of the sky, so now you can legally have lunch. No!
You are not buying my poetic premises today.
This is the 21st century, Jack. And the sun is... We wake by alarm clocks, not by roosters and sunlight. I'm sorry. It just doesn't work
that
way. I
wish I could help you out by thinking... Let's suppose...
I am not going to depend on running so that on Venus to get the sun in the middle of the sky at my command... So that I can have lunch.
Okay. All right. But let's suppose you're a rooster and you like to crow at dawn. That's just a deep feeling.
You could totally mess with a rooster this way.
Yes. That's what I want to do.
Usain Bolt carrying a rooster with him.
Usain Bolt carries a rooster on Venus. He does in a remarkably fast sprint. The rooster, having started the run in the middle of the day, well past the crowing period, feels a strange compulsion to crow 2 hours into the run.
Because he ran backwards to the sunrise.
Forwards, but the sun went backwards.
Yes, he ran in the other way to reverse the sun back to sunrise. Yeah, and the rooster is will need therapy.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with
the stars up above. Well, okay, I can think of nothing else to do at this point except take a break.
Okay, so I'm going to lie down, but what's your name again?
Chad Abumrad.
Okay, mine's Robert Krulwich.
We'll be back. You know, we're not actually going anywhere, so we're not really being back.
No.
Just, we'll rejoin you after this break.
After this small turn of the earth.
This is Christine Stone from Maplewood, New Jersey. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And next up.
What's so interesting about the cicada sounds is when you just hear it for the first time, you just hear white noise. You just hear just noise. But when you learn what's going on, you can hear the different parts of the orchestra.
That's David Rothenberg, composer and professor and writer. And what he's going to do is he's going to take that huge wall of insect sounds and get really into it, really start to dissect it. Ooh. But what he really loves to do, really, is he likes to play music with animals. So he goes around and finds individual animals or groups of animals to duet with. One of the first times he tried this was with a...
Well, that was a white-crested laughing thrush. Washington has them. Bronx Zoo has them. They thrive very well in zoos. But what they do is they sing duets, the males and females together.
So that's animals singing with animals. But here's what he did. He went to the National Aviary, which is in Pittsburgh.
First, I stepped into the big tropical aviary where you wander and the birds are flying freely. It's a big, warm, kind of moist space.
He got there
before the aviary opened, like 6 a.m.
And there were, when he walked into the cage, there were dozens of different kinds of birds flying around.
And I was walking with my clarinet.
Playing, you know, up to the trees.
Why is he doing this?
Well, he just wanted to see what... That's him, by the way. Uh-huh. And he wanted to see what would happen.
All right.
And as it turns out, nothing happened. The birds just more or less ignored him.
By then, I was kind of lost interest, like nobody's paying attention to this. It's a bad idea. And then all of a sudden...
Oh, hello.
The laughing thrush was interested.
That's the thrush. One little guy, brown feathers, dark beak.
And at that moment... Anyone would say,
And they're like doing call and response.
Yeah.
This is interesting. Something's happening here. This bird and this clarinetist are doing something together.
So as you're playing, well, what's going on in your mind at this point?
I was just imagining I was sitting down with a musician who I maybe couldn't talk to, spoke another language besides English. And I couldn't talk to this musician, but I could make music together with them.
Okay, so that was his encounter with a thrush. Let me take you on another little adventure, just before we get to our big thing. After a variety of bird duets, in which I'm sure he frustrated many a thrush, he then did a duet with an entirely different animal.
What the?
Yeah, well, humpback whales. The best thing about that story is nobody knew they sang until the 1960s, so you can train
Don't whales spend most of their time, except for the tops of them, underwater? So where
they
would you be?
Good point. I was broadcasting my clarinet through an underwater speaker. Listening with headphones to what's coming out of an underwater microphone. And you hear... this duet from down there, live clarinet and whale.
This is so bizarre. What does the whale make of this?
I don't speak whale.
The thing about humpback whales is, unlike most animals, they change their songs from year to year. They're interested in new sounds. So all the humpback whales in any one ocean are singing one song, and then they change it altogether. No one knows why. Why do they want to change their song if they all want to sound the same?
Well, when you sung your song with the whale, did the whale react like the thrush?
I think it's different, but I would say the whale seemed to change what he was doing.
Now, it can be a little hard to hear exactly what David's talking about. It took me a few listens to pick out the distinguishing moment. But here's what the whale was doing when David showed up. It was doing this thing where it would go whoop and then down and whoop and then down. Over and over. And here's what it started doing a few minutes after he'd been playing the clarinet. The whale kind of extends the note.
Whales tend to go ooh, and clarinets tend to go ooh. They play a steady tone, you know. And so the whale was trying to play a more steady note.
I don't know.
You can't hear that. Just a little bit of an extended line. It's instead of it's.
I mean, it's awesome. No, I love listening to this, but I don't. It just sounds like the whale's still doing whale.
Well, David says that when he played the recording to some of the whale scientists,
they all are shocked.
All?
Every scientist I played that to did not believe that what I played them was actually a live recording. They thought I'd done something to it, which I didn't.
I mean, they'd never heard a whale make a sound like that, I'm assuming.
Which implies that the whale was reacting to his clarinet?
Well,
because maybe the whale was just saying, shut up!
Shut up there!
Well, however you want to resolve it, like we should move on to the real purpose of our gathering here this afternoon, or okay, whatever time you're listening to this.
2 a.m.
Which is that he then turned to this sound right here.
The plague.
This is the sound of lots of cicadas, and when you and I hear it, I mean, it just sounds like an enormous block of monotonal noise.
Yes, sir.
Just screech, you know, an elaborate screech.
Annoying.
But David says, actually, if you know what's going on in here, if you learn to dissect it, well,
pretty soon you can pick out up to 9 separate sounds made by the 3 related species of cicada that are there at the same time.
Can you walk us through the 9 different sounds?
Well, at least some of them.
By the way, that was our producer, Lynn Levy.
Okay, we have 3 basic species that come out whenever there's an emergence. They're all there.
So I didn't, you know, realize that this was when you're walking through the woods and you hear this enormous white noise. What you're actually hearing are 3 different kinds of cicadas, 3 different species singing 3 very different songs that are all mixed together so you can't tell them apart.
Huh.
And then each one of those songs, each of those 3, has 3 parts, which is how you get to the number 9. In any case, here are the 3 species. This is number 1.
Magicicada cassini makes the white noise sound. Shh. Shh. And they swell together. They synchronize. So they'll all go. And then they fly around a bit. Do that now. Jump up from your seat, and you get back in, and you do it again. There you go.
Okay, so that's species number 1. Now, here is species number 2.
Magicicada septendecula is making like... It's kind of irregular.
So that's the bebop guy.
Kind of, yeah, and there's fewer of those, and they're quieter, so less is known about them.
Can I hear that one again? So we got the white noise one, the bebop one. Now here's number 3.
Magicicada septendecim, the most popular known sound. And that's going the pharaoh sound. Pharaoh.
Wow.
And the thing is, when you actually hear millions of them, all you hear is... If you take 1 and multiply it hundreds and then thousands of times, its tail disappears. You just hear this tone.
I mean, this is what we hear, but what would the cicada hear in all this?
Ah, well, this is the whole story.
Well, see, the thing about cicadas is that the cicadas who sing here are the males, just the guys, and they sing it's a mating song, really. You know, there are lots of songs you sing, but this is it's one of those kind. And the idea being...
The females hear all this sound and they find the males. Like the grand mess of music, like a disco, or it's called a lek by biologists, which pretty much means disco anyway. And
if
then,
you were a guy looking for a date, you might not join with lots of other guys, but these animals join together for what purpose?
So the females can find them.
But if you've got like a billion cicadas crowded into a disco, then how does a single male and a single female notice each other?
They don't have to. They just bump into each other and then it's on.
No.
17 years ago, John Cooley and David Marshall discovered things were more complicated than that. They discovered the females make a sound after the male finishes his sound.
So say you're one of these males.
Going, Phil. And the female has to make a wing flick, this tiny little flick, exactly 1/3 of a second after the male stops.
Really? So it's like...
And then, nobody imagined such a thing was going on. They didn't imagine insects were doing anything this complicated.
Well, for one thing, it sounds like that would be a male-to-female bit of business, one-to-one. When you listen to all these animals, you don't think they ever have a one of them. They're like so many of them.
Millions of males are making the pharaoh sound, but when you're close to one, You know, the female hears Pharaoh. If there's one close enough, she makes the wing flick, and the male knows to approach her a little bit, and he goes on with a second sound. It's called, by John Cooley, court two. Court two is like... Pharaoh, 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 Pharaoh. And then she makes the wing flick again.
Same one?
As far as we know.
Okay. Where does that tell Mr. I love you guy?
It's time to start mating and make the third sound, which is more like...
Let's do that again. So your hello is Pharaoh.
Yeah.
I'm getting closer is...
Pharaoh, Pharaoh, Pharaoh.
And now we're kissing, et cetera, is... So now you know, when the cicadas come and you hear this massive roar, what you're really hearing is an orchestra of sex. Just think of all these little animals getting ready to do what they were born to do, what they've been waiting 17 long years in the ground to do. And all the while, it's the songs that matter.
They're like following these little rules, simple rules that together, it shows how very simple organisms can create things of great complexity and beauty. Each individual doesn't have to know that much about the whole. And still interesting things happen, which gives you a different view of human life. You're one little part in this giant thing. You don't have to really know what's happening, but you're doing your little bit for the whole of creation or evolution or life or music. And you do your own little thing, and you're not sure where it leads.
But for the individual cicada, for Tommy cicada or Betty cicada, it's all pretty simple. They have their sex. They lay eggs on twigs of trees. The eggs hatch, and then tiny little larvae cicadas will fall to the ground, and then they'll burrow into the warm earth.
And attach themselves to the roots of trees.
And then start sucking the fluid from tree roots, and they will do this for years and years and years.
It's just slowly growing.
And then for some reason that nobody can quite fathom, at the exact same moment, it's body time.
There are different broods of them, so different years you can go somewhere in the country and maybe there's some coming out.
And why is it that the one that's about to come out here in the Northeast, why does that happen only every 17 years? Why 17?
The honest answer is we really don't know. We do have some evidence of how they keep track of the years, which is that the cicada monitors the temperature. We don't know how, but that's what they pay attention to.
So in the ground, they're not just eating tree juice. They're also got a little thermometer.
Somehow they're paying it. They have a little counting thermometer. They count the number of years, then they know when to come out. A few years ago in my parents' house, I did see one in the wrong year. You know, every year, a few of them wake up. Where's the party?
Oh, really? You have Rip Van Winkle ones?
Yeah, they don't always count correctly. You know?
Oh, really? That must be a lonely experience.
Yeah, the lonely cicada looking for its kind, the wrong year, the wrong place.
Can they go back down and go back to that?
Or is it, I don't think
the
so.
The jig
no.
is up.
They've changed. They come from their larval stage and the wings have come out. They can't crawl back and lose the wings.
Did it sing, that lone cicada?
Yeah, it was singing.
To no one.
To no one. To me.
And you can kind of imagine David picking up his clarinet and joining in. Thanks to John Cooley and to David Marshall. And now Jed wants to say something.
What do I want to say?
About Glenn Levy's favorite song.
Oh, and if you go to, radiolab.org, you can download a song from David Rothenberg's album, Chosen, by our producer, Glenn Levy. It is her favorite song. You can download it for free. Also, David Rothenberg has a new book out called Bug Music.
And if you happen to be on the East Coast, we have you can do this from any coast you like, but we have a map where you can track where these little critters are popping up.
I'll be frying them up, making some tempura.
No, you won't. No,
I'll
you
be
won't.
Making
no,
tempura.
Because the little guy will come up to you and go, fatigata, 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 on your leg. You'll drop to the ground and burrow into the earth. And we won't see you for, I don't know, it'll be like either 13 or 17 years.
All right, up next, we're gonna leave the ground where the cicadas live and are burrowing right now or whatever they're doing. And we're going to go up to space.
Oh, that'll be nice. That's a nice change of pace.
It is.
It's colder. It's very, 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 very
change
dry.
Of space and a change of pace.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Keep listening.
This is Alicia Bridges calling from Saskatoon in Saskatchewan. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café, s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
So we've been talking about rotating and crawling into the Earth and rotating around the sun and...
Time, space. Well, no, we haven't talked about space yet. No. That's about to happen. In this next segment, we're going to go up into space, 200 miles above the Earth. This story actually comes from a live show we did years ago called In the Dark. It was a sort of big, broad collaboration with video people and dancers. And this is one of our favorite stories from that show.
Yeah.
We should also note that this story was scored live by the amazing Tao Nguyen, with Jason Slota on the drums, Jamie Riota on the bass, and it was recorded masterfully at UCLA's Royce Hall by Reverend John Delore.
So here it is.
So for our final segment, we were thinking through this show. We thought, you know, who would have a really interesting perspective on darkness?
Maybe somebody who works in a rich, dark environment. Astronauts, for example.
Yeah. So we called up NASA. We talked to an astronaut. We connected our little studio in New York to their studio in D.C. to talk to an astronaut, but he was a little late. And here's the funny thing. When you are on hold with NASA, this is literally what you hear. This has a blast-off feel to it.
Yeah, it does.
This is amazing.
This, by the way, is literally the case. You dial 1-800-NASA or whatever, and this is like go to the moon music. Hello?
I hear someone breathing. Can you hear me?
It's probably I'm breathing.
That's an interesting way to meet.
So this is our guy, Dave Wolf is his name. He's a NASA astronaut.
I have been since 1990, over 20 years.
He wasn't really sure why we had called him.
What's our topic here?
So yeah. We explained to him that, you know, we're doing this show called In the Dark. We're going to do it on stage in front of some very nice folks. Do you have any stories that relate? And right off the bat, he says,
you've triggered an interesting darkness story I have.
Mm. Well, that's why we're calling you up.
Yeah.
Okay, you're taping and you're ready.
Yep.
Darkness is an interesting theme in space because there's nowhere where the contrast between light and dark is any more extreme.
Dave has done dozens of spacewalks, and he says there have been times when he's just sort of out there floating in space next to the craft, and maybe the ship tilts a little bit, and the wing blocks light that's coming from the sun or the moon, and it creates a shadow. And he says the darkness of that shadow
is blacker than any black you thought it could be out there in space. The shadow has no light in it. There's not reflected light from dust in the air, the earth around you, or clouds.
It's just pure, absolute dark.
And you can reach into a shadow so deep, so black, that your arm can appear to disappear.
Wow.
Right in front of your face. Your head is in the bright light, and your arm is in this depth of darkness.
And it's just gone? Like it's been cut off?
Yeah.
Wow.
But I do want to tell you an experience I had in my first space walk. Late 97, I had this experience.
Okay.
It was from a Russian spacecraft. You might remember the Mir.
Yeah, sure.
Spacecraft.
So Dave was up there. He was with two Russian cosmonauts. And he and Anatoly Solovyev, they were suited up and getting ready to make their first walk into space, or his first walk.
And we did all the preparations to get the suits ready, and we're in the airlock, and
the door opened, and they floated out.
We clipped our tethers on outside.
And he and Anatoly gently float to the worksite.
And it was dark out, and dark up in space means you're on the night side of the Earth, in the shadow of the Earth, and there were no external lights on this spacecraft. This was really, really dark. And we were over the ocean, and at night, that basically means you don't see the Earth.
You don't see it at all?
Not at all. When it's a moonless night, you don't see the Earth. In fact, all it might look like to you is the absence of stars.
Now, I want you to imagine this with me. He's up there in this darkness, and the Earth, with all of us on it, is somewhere far, far below him, but he can't see it. And all the while, and this is really important for what happens next, he is shooting through space. He's rocketing across the dark shadow of the Earth at 5 miles a second. That is 16 times the speed that we're all moving right now, because we are on the Earth. But he says at that moment he didn't feel any of that. It just felt like he was suspended in this cocoon of black.
Floating gently.
And he thought, all right.
No problem.
This is kind of peaceful.
Because it was just me and the spacecraft and blackness. And suddenly, this blazing light
blasts him from below.
What was it?
It was the sunrise. You know, because he and the ship were moving so quickly that the sunrise, which normally happens here on Earth very, very slowly, calmly, at that speed up there, the sun comes screaming from the eastern edge of the Earth straight across the Earth, lights up everything in seconds.
And the Earth lights up below me. Suddenly I can look down 200 miles and see that we're moving at 5 miles per second.
Oceans, whoosh. Clouds, whoosh, deserts, whoosh. And he was like, ah.
And I clutched onto these handrails like there's no tomorrow, white knuckled in my spacesuit gloves, because I suddenly had this enormous sense of height and speed.
He says it was sort of like if you're just standing comfortably on the ground and then someone just flips on the lights suddenly and you realize, actually, I'm not on the ground. I am on a 400,000 foot ladder. Crazier still, in that sunrise moment.
The temperature also increases by upwards of 400 degrees.
In the moment?
In the moment.
Really?
This is the most extreme thing I've ever heard.
Are you air conditioned or whatever? Are you?
You are. You're totally dependent on that spacesuit. But the colors, what you're seeing on that Earth is so spectacular. The greens and blues and the delicate pastel-like colors and the contrast and the brights aren't present in anything I've ever seen other than up in space.
Dave and his Russian buddy Anatoly, they're out there for hours doing repairs on the ship, so they are, because of their speed, they're going in and out and in and out of these days and nights.
So it's 90 minutes of a light dark cycle. So you have 16 nights and 16 days for every Earth day.
Which means, as they're working, this change is happening over and over and over. Every 45 minutes, they go from blazing light to quiet dark. Blazing light to darkness.
You can get lost. You get stories of people doing spacewalks that lose their orientation or feel like they're falling.
And so he says the only thing to do in that circumstance is just to focus on your job. Look straight ahead. Only at the screw. Only at the screw.
Don't look down. It's kind of, it's real in this business.
So, we would have been perfectly happy to end the story right here, because Dave and Anatoly finished their repairs, job well done, they get ready to come back into the spacecraft, but we cannot not tell you what happens next.
Yeah, because this flirts with a very different kind of darkness.
Yeah. So the two of them pull themselves by their tethers to come back into the airlock, to go back in.
But when it was time to come back in,
they couldn't get back in.
You were locked out of your spaceship?
You could call it locked out. We were trapped outside, yes.
Essentially, their airlock was busted. They couldn't repressurize it. And if you can't get it at the right pressure, you can't re-enter.
No.
And we worked on it for 4 or 5 hours and ran out our resources. And we
Wait a second. Ran out of oxygen or what?
We have plenty of oxygen, it turns out. What you run out of first is your carbon dioxide scrubbing unit that takes the CO2 out of your suit. And now the problem with this one is, usually in a space accident, you figure it'll only hurt for a moment. But when you die of CO2 intoxication, that drags out. That's a miserable way to go.
What does he mean? Did you ever find out?
I looked it up. What happens is first you get a headache, and then your muscles start to twitch. Eventually, your heartbeat starts to accelerate faster, faster, faster. You go into convulsions, and then you die.
Luckily, the life support system has an extra cartridge. That gave us an extra 6 or so hours. We used all that. And trying to fix the hatch, and we couldn't get it to hold air. And we were done.
Did you know you were done? I mean,
Yeah, pretty much. And
you mean done like in over?
Yeah, no more ideas.
Done like in dead.
Mm.
So, they decide, okay, we gotta do something. Last ditch maneuver, if we can't get our usual airlock to work, maybe we can make a new one. Because see, on the Mir space station, it's this big cylinder with these rectangular modules that jut out, and one of those modules is the airlock. But there are these adjacent ones, which are normally just living quarters. They thought, well, if we can't get our usual airlock to pressurize at the right, pressure, maybe we can go to the next one over and try and pressurize it.
Essentially treating that next module in as a airlock, and we opened the hatch into that next module. And in order, though, to go into it, we had to disconnect our umbilicals, because you can't close a hatch over your umbilical, right? And the umbilical was providing our cooling to our suits. So as soon as we disconnected, well, that gives you maybe 5-8 minutes at max.
Before you what?
I don't even want to talk about it. It's so bad.
Did you look that up?
Yeah, I looked this one up too. Essentially what happens is you boil inside your spacesuit.
In a very ugly way.
So, Dave and Anatoly think, okay, we've got to get through this tiny hatch into this room, and they've got to do it fast. But they also know,
if you struggle hard and go too fast, you won't get much time at all in that suit before that heat builds up on you.
So he thinks, okay, hurry, hurry, but slowly. Slowly.
What I did not anticipate was, as soon as we disconnected our umbilicals, that the visor would fog up. And you'd now be having to feel your
way
through.
So you're blind?
Yeah. You could spit and kind of get a little area through the fog. So I'm in the airlock trying to make my way into the next section, and I was crawling along the wall moving into the next section, and I spit on my visor, you know, to make a little hole to look through and get a hint. And it was an area I had been sleeping in some weeks before, and I had left a picture of my family taped with scotch tape on the wall, and I spit on the visor, and my helmet light went there, and there was this picture of my family right here in this moment as I was scooting across the wall in what was likely my last minutes. So this is how it's gonna end. So this is it. And look, it's so strange. There they are. And I look back at that, and I shudder.
Now, of course, Dave and his partner made it back into the space station. Barely.
But it didn't strike me, really, till months later on the Earth, how close that had been. And what a strange situation.
This Russian guy must be your best friend. Like he must
be.
You have to probably call each other and say, 20 years later, you go,
Well, not many people have been through anything like that together and are there to talk about it. And you just reminded me of something.
So we're going to leave you with one last story from Dave. He was kind of a story machine. This is from that same stay in space, involves the same friend, Anatoly. They were out there doing some work on the ship, you know, floating in space again. And then Mission Control radios in, tells them to pause for a while.
We had a period where we had to wait through the night to go on with our work. So he says, look, David, it was all in Russian, of course, I wanted to show you something. And we hooked our tethers on, pushed ourselves about 6 feet away. We had about 6 feet of tether, so that our eyes couldn't see anything but out in space. And I turned my air conditioner down a little, you know, so it was kind of warm. And I was floating in this spacesuit, just looking out into the blackness of space. And I felt like I didn't have a spacesuit on. It was so comfortable. The air temperature was just right. I felt like I was just out in the universe, in the stars. I couldn't see anything but stars all around me, and I couldn't feel anything. Outside a spacecraft going 5 miles per second out in the universe.
Was that what he wanted to show you?
Yeah, I think so.
This is his rocking chair on the front porch thing.
Or a hammock, almost. He didn't want to talk. He said, let's just be quiet, turn your helmet light off so you don't get any reflected light. Just relax. Raslabavayet. Relax. 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 Relax.
Now, had you been there in the theater, this is the moment where we gave everybody a little pinpoint of light, a little hand-carried star that they could put over their heads and wave together.
Like 2,000 tiny little lights from the seats. It's like a canopy of stars. We saw this happen again and again, like 18 times I think we performed this, and every time it was just like breathtaking.
Yeah. Thank you.
This whole show came together thanks to so many people on stage and off, and we want to make a couple of thank yous before we go.
Very, very special thanks to Meg Bowles, who found our astronaut.
She found Dave Wolf.
Yes. Also to Palabolas, the dance company, and to the Palabola.
Yes, starting with Itamar Kubovi.
Lily Binns.
Matt Kent.
Renee Jaworski.
Greg Laffey.
Yes.
And the dancers.
Chris Whitney.
Heather Favretto.
Anthony Oliva.
Christina Conger.
Evan Adler.
Annika Schief.
And the Olvera twins, Edwin and
Roberto. We love you guys.
Yeah.
Dimitri Martin, thank you so much for coming and, you know, creating this show with us. Tao Nguyen and Jason Slota, thank you so much to them. And Mike Faba.
Jake Fine.
Serena Wong.
John Delore.
Melissa Lacasse.
Dave Foley.
Nick Nusiforo.
Caitlin Fitzwater.
Rebecca Lehrer.
And Roslyn Lutine.
Lutz.
Lutz. Most of all, most of all, to Alan Horn, who loved doing this and made it so fun to do.
Hey, this is Liza. And it would be unlike me to pass up a staff credit. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Soren Wheeler is senior editor. Jamie York is our senior producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, David Gable, Tracy Hunt, Matt Kielty, Robert Krawich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Arian Wack, and Molly Webster, with help from Valentina Bohanini, Nagar Fatali, Phoebe Wang, and Katie Ferguson. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.